Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Everyone already knows that walking is good for us. We were made to walk. But still, there is research, and it backs up the notion showing that walking comes with a host of benefits that range from heart health to creativity to concentration. We're talking about walking today, why it's good for us, and where to walk in Central Ohio. Joining us is the founding CEO of the national nonprofit Walk with a Doc program and cardiologist at Mount Carmel St. Anne's, Dr. David Sabger. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I should say welcome back. We have chatted before because walking never goes out of style, right?
Never. It's the miracle drug. Thanks,
Ann. You bet. And from Columbus Public Health Department, where he manages the Columbus Art Walks and the Columbus Neighborhood Walk with a Doc program, Phil Hansen, welcome back.
Great. Thanks.
I was saying earlier that it was a press release I received about an architecture walk. And I'm like, wait a minute, an architecture walk? In the Columbus Public Health Department, what's that about? And that kind of spurred my ongoing interest for today's purposes. Listeners, what are some of your favorite spots to walk in Central Ohio? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org and tell us why you like that place. Tell us where it is and share the info. Dr. Sabger, is there a right or wrong way to walk?
Not really a wrong way. I think it's that's why we utilize it as physicians as a wonderful way to be active and really reduce your risk of heart disease, cancer, arthritis, anxiety, depression, you name it. And fortunately, most everyone can do it. And even if you can't, getting out and walk rolling is fantastic as well.
What do you mean walk rolling?
Using a wheelchair.
Okay.
'Cause not all of us can do it. But being out in nature has additional synergistic effects.
How did you start the Walk with the Doc program?
I was so frustrated at my inability to get my patients out and moving. And walking is the miracle drug. It's the fountain of youth, physical activity. So one day I just said, hey, how about if my family and I were at the park, would you join us? And that really started to snowball. And now we end up with fantastic partners like the City of Columbus, Columbus Public Health.
And other places around the country.
302 places around the country. So it's really caught on. We're in 45 states and 10 other countries now. I work with a couple incredible women, Rachel Hobash and Jessica Oliver, that really are starting walks every day.
It does say something about the idea of a taste of your own medicine too, right? For physicians?
Yeah, absolutely. It's great for the docs to get out and be active, and the friendships that I formed with the community members is worth its weight in gold. I love the program.
Phil, you have a master's in public health and city and regional planning, which probably explains the architecture tour, right? But how do those two fields work together?
Yeah, so it's kind of funny that you say it explains the architecture, because I was really excited to come to Columbus Public Health and find out we had a program like that, because it's an interest of mine, but it's not something that I brought to us. It's really something that already existed, which is great that something like that was here in Columbus. I got into kind of both public health and city planning because it occurred to me that, you know, not everyone has access to the things they need to walk and be active, just depending on where they live in cities or in rural areas. The types of infrastructure that we have that allows people to be active, that encourages people to be active, is, you know, at least half of the battle in terms of getting people to be living a healthy and active lifestyle. So I thought if I could have an impact not only on kind of the encouragement side, but on creating that environment, then we could really expand what we can do to keep people healthy.
I think you're right on about the rural areas, or any area, particularly in Columbus, is known for its areas that don't have sidewalks. They're very dangerous, or they can be very dangerous in rural areas as well. Cars are speeding down the road, and it's not a safe place to walk.
Yeah, there's definitely some issues when we're running into areas without sidewalks or with high traffic, high speed areas. You know, safety is really important. You know, we encourage people, if you are walking in an area like that, walk actually on the opposite side of the road so you can see traffic coming if you have to walk in the street. But ideally, if you can't find a safe place to walk in your neighborhood, Columbus does have a lot of really wonderful parks. We have areas that are off the road. We have beautiful trails. So walking in your neighborhood is great, and we do have resources to help with that on our website. We have neighborhood walking maps that people can find safe routes around the area, but our parks and trails are wonderful as well.
Dr. Sabger, when you would encourage your patients to walk, just get out and walk, what were their complaints? What would they say back to you?
There's a lot of issues with the weather. I'd see a patient, say now, and it'd been too cold for the last 6 months, and I'll see him in November, and it'll have been too hot. So we kind of need to adjust for that. I think there's a lot of people are active at work, and that's great. It's a lot better than a desk job. There's a pretty widespread perception that they're getting the physical activity that they need at work, and that's not always the case.
What's the difference between walking around just in your regular day and walking as a form of exercise?
That's a great question. If you do it as regular exercise, the heart likes the body, the heart rate likes to be up for at least 10 minutes in a row. So if you're working somewhere, you may go for a long walk. You know, a physician may walk down an incredibly long corridor, but they're going to stop and check a patient chart or something like that. So it's keeping the heart rate up. And ideally, we like our patients and the community in general to go at least 3 miles an hour. There's a study that says the Grim Reaper walks at 3 miles an hour, so we like to stay ahead of him. Or 100 steps a minute. And we shoot for 150 minutes total per week. So about 20 to 25 minutes a day.
And ideally, how much difference does that make?
Oh, my gosh. With your health, there's over 50 diseases, let alone the increased self-esteem, morale. It's really a game changer. There's no question.
And so 150 minutes a week, that's not much. You could do that 25 minutes a day, right?
I agree. Or you could go for a couple longer walks on the weekend, or if you like to bike ride or swim or any other physical activity, just at moderate pace really is dramatic. Finally, 80% of cardiovascular disease is preventable. So the ball's really in our court, which is great.
It's better than prescribing medicines?
There are times where we absolutely need medicine, but there's a lot of medicines that could be avoided just by regular physical activity.
Columbus Public Health and the Columbus Landmarks Foundation kicked off a season of free art walks and landmark talks. Phil, can you tell us more about how you collaborate with Columbus Landmarks?
Yeah. Like I said, this is a program that really gets me excited because it shows people places to walk in their neighborhood where they can view art and architecture, where they can really experience the city of Columbus in a new way. Columbus Landmarks Foundation is a great partner. We have wonderful volunteer tour guides that they provide that lead these hour-long guided walks. They're just fountains of information about the city, about its history, about the buildings that we drive past at 35, 40 miles an hour a lot of the time. But if you really slow down and walk on the sidewalks and look around, we're just surrounded by really beautiful architecture.
How do you make sure that the walk is also a healthy walk versus edifying, historically?
Yeah. So our participants like to give me a hard time when I'm at the walks because I'm kind of trying to encourage them to walk a little faster
or
nudging our tour guides to move on when we talk too long. Because I do try to make sure we're really using it as a walk and not just kind of sightseeing. So yeah, we design the walks to provide those breaks to talk, but really when we go between our different sites where we're walking, we try to pick up the pace and really make it a good time to get even just those little 10-minute bouts of exercise, which is easy to do when we have an hour. We can stop and talk for a while and enjoy the weather and enjoy the architecture, but we can get those little walks in too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How long does the series last? It goes through the summer?
Yep, it'll go through the summer. We have 14 walks. We just finished our second in Clintonville last night. They're Monday evenings except for major holiday weekends. And actually, we'll be announcing more about a new program. We're going to do 4 additional walks at the end of the year, which we're in the planning stages of, and those will be called culture walks. Those will focus more on kind of the people and the stories of neighborhoods and less on the buildings and the architecture.
How many people can you handle in a given walk?
Well, we've actually been kind of pushed to the limit a few times by our attendance, which has been really wonderful last year and this year. We averaged almost 100 last year in Clintonville. Last night, we had 135.
Wow.
And so we have to have oftentimes 3 or more tour guides to break up the group into
right.
small enough segments to keep everybody together, to cross the street and, you know, in the time we have allotted and things like that. So, yeah, we've had walks of 150 or more, and we welcome people to continue to join us. We'll make it work. We'll find the tour guides if you want to come walk.
And, you know, you talked about a little bit earlier, Dr. Sabger, about, you know, a lot of times people sit complain about the weather, but walking when it's cold outside is perfectly healthy, right?
It is.
Safe,
it is.
I should say.
It is safe. There are times where if it's, you know, gets down to those silly temperatures mm-hmm. that you want to cover your mouth with a scarf to warm the air coming in. But for most everyone, it's very safe.
And as far as hot weather goes, I just bring a bottle of water with me if I'm
yeah.
going to walk. I do get thirsty and it makes me anxious if I don't have water. But other than that, walking shouldn't exert that much energy, right?
Exactly. I think it's great that you bring water. Staying hydrated before, during, after is key.
People who are obese, who are really, really out of shape. I know walking is a great way to get started, but are there any extra precautions for people in that situation?
You know, it's not a bad idea to check with your doctor just and let them know that it's something you're going to embark on. Usually we're more concerned about patients that are not going to participate in physical activity.
Kevin in Pataskala, you're on the air. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, great show again. Great show.
Thanks.
I wonder if they are familiar with the study of, I don't know, it was done by one of the Ivy League universities. I can't remember if it was Harvard or Yale. But they did a study, and they said that, and it was due to mindfulness and exercise. And they were talking, they set up one hotel, did a study between two hotel sets of hotel workers.
Uh-huh.
And one of the hotel workers, they told them that everything they did, folding sheets, vacuuming, going up and down the stairs, car valet, everything. They told them everything you did was amounted to at some form of exercise. And, of course, with the other set of hotel workers at the other hotel, they told them just the opposite.
Huh.
And they saw significant results with the ones that were mindful.
Like what kind of results? What do you mean?
I don't remember all of it. The study was done some years ago. You can Google it. It'll come up online. My thing is, I'm highly mindful now of I walk, but I'm mindful of little things too. When I'm cutting the grass, I try to stay vigorous, like you say, and active for 10 minutes straight or more, and, you know, just to break that light sweat. But also with everything else, if I'm doing the dishes, you know, I'm standing there, I'm trying to flex my knees and stuff, not lock my knees. Every little bit adds up, because I started from a bad position of being really overweight, and then, you know, you can get caught behind the eight ball there in a catch-22 situation.
Yeah.
You can't move, but you got to start somewhere. So,
yeah.
Great show again. But,
thanks, Kevin.
Mindfulness and everything. I was called because he said the surgeon that had to walk the long hallways. Well, there's a couple surgeons at the James where I used to work. They wear pedometers, and they keep track of their mileage every day. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. Yeah, that's kind of interesting, Kevin's approach to that.
Yeah. I love what Kevin said, and I think it's great. It kind of makes me think about taking the stairs instead of the elevator, parking far away. But I also agree with Kevin in the pedometers. I have one on right now on my wrist, and I think it kind of allows you to keep score with yourself. And exactly to his point, all those little things add up. So good for him.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's great. You know, it reminds me of some other public health work I've done working with families. You know, we encourage people, you know, hey, turn on some music when you're cleaning the house, you know, dance a little bit, you know, speed it up, do some things like that, that you're just everyday activities can turn into exercise if you can think about it and make it fun.
Having a dog walking is mm-hmm. a great thing, too. And it was funny. I saw something on Facebook or something about a woman who said she just didn't have enough time to walk her dog and she wanted to adopt the dog out to somebody who had more time. And I looked and she was really involved in weightlifting and physical activity and all this kind of junk. And I thought it was kind of sad yeah. that she discounted the benefit, the physical benefit of walking a dog.
We have two dogs that are...
Where it's very structured. Exercise is one thing and everything else is something else.
That's exactly right. And the dog's going to be standing at the front door, you know, maybe with a leash in his or her mouth ready to go. So it's a wonderful prompt. And it makes me think of, you know, is walking equivalent to running? And, you know, for all intents and purposes, it is. It just takes maybe a little longer, but you get the same benefits. Let's say you're going to cover 2 or 3 miles, whether you're jogging or walking, you get the same health benefits with lower impact.
And as far as that kind of how you walk, you know, obviously it's a little bit different with what you're doing, Phil Hansen, with the walking program for Columbus Public Health. There is going to be a stop and go kind of an aspect to it. But what about the whole idea of speed walking? That's a real thing, too. Does it, you know, people are worried. You're saying about 3 miles an hour is a good pace.
Which would be a 20-minute mile. And there was a study done in the last, I think it was 2014, where they found a significant benefit going over 3 miles an hour. But for the people that may be listening that are currently walking at 2.5, you know, you're not going to get to 3 if you're not working your way and doing 2, 2.5 miles an hour. So anything is helpful. So that's, you know, a lot of people have called it the gateway to better health, walking.
All right. Well, Dr. David Sabger, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Dr. David Sabger is the cardiologist and founder of the nonprofit Walk with a Doc. And also, Phil Hansen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. I was happy to be here.
Phil Hansen is the walking programs manager for Columbus Public Health. They are collaborating with Columbus Landmarks Foundation and they recently kicked off its season of free art walks and landmark walks. And we'll have a link on our website to that at WOSU.org/all sides if you want to check it out. More Health Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In the United States, 8 out of every 10 people will experience back pain at some point in their lives. Sufferers often turn to chiropractics, physical therapy, or prescription pain medicine to treat the symptoms, and all that costs Americans roughly $50 billion a year. Investigative journalist Catherine Jacobson-Raymond argues that those methods are not just costly, but often ineffective. She wrote about the topic in a new book entitled Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Thanks so very much. I'm delighted to be here.
So,
I think that number is closer to $100 billion a year, by the way.
Really?
Although maybe you may have parsed it in some way that I did not, but
well,
when you add up all the medicine plus disability costs, plus what the device industry makes and the pharmaceutical industry makes, it does come out to about $100 billion a year, which is staggering when you're talking about the high cost of health care, particularly because much, if not most, of those expenditures are unnecessary and unhelpful to people with low back pain.
What is the deal? Are we mostly talking about low back pain? And what is the deal with the U.S.? Why are we just chronically prone to lifting with our back instead of our knees or something?
I mean, no,
what? Is it cultural?
We are talking about the U.S., although the U.K. and Australia and a number of other well-developed countries are just as prone to this. But we are not talking about fragility or structural failure. We're talking about a medical industrial complex that has really taken off in the past 20 to 25 years. As late as the mid-70s, there was practically no low back surgery, very little. And that certainly is not the case. And it was also true in the 70s that there was almost no prescription. I can say absolutely no prescription of narcotic painkillers, opioids, to treat low back pain problems. And, of course, we know how that turned on us.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, it's not a matter of fragility. We are not any weaker. We are more sedentary, that is for sure. And that speaks actually to what I heard of your last caller, who was making some really good points about getting up and moving.
Mm-hmm.
But truly, this is a situation where business has maximized its profits at the expense of many innocent and potentially rather naive patients who really listen very closely to anything that anyone in a white coat has to say.
Are we mostly talking about low back pain?
Yes, we are.
Why is that the culprit so much?
Well, it's really interesting. You know, my book focuses on low back pain, and people go, well, what about my neck, and what about my knees, and what about my hips, and what about... Well, yeah, but certainly cervical surgery, which is neck surgery, is not prone to this kind of abuse and misuse and overuse. The reason that low back pain has become such a target is that it's not something you can see. It's not something that is readily diagnosed through any tests or scans. And it is not something that you can say a person definitely does not have. You know, I mean, if you come in with a broken ankle, I can say, yes, you have a broken ankle, or no, you do not have a broken ankle. Mm. That does not work that way with back pain. And historically, we've been seeing a tremendous number of MRIs, an enormous increase in those numbers in the past two decades. And what's seen on an MRI is not truly diagnostic, and people rarely... patients rarely grasp that.
What? Tell us what you mean by that. I mean, what's the distinction there?
All right. So you go to see your primary care doctor, and you say, "Doctor, my back is killing me. I can't do anything. I can't get to work, and I really want an MRI." And your doctor, your primary care doctor these days, your primary care doctor knows that MRI is the most overused medical procedure out there. And your primary care doctor says, "Now listen, I want you to give it 2-3 more weeks." And you say, "No, I want an MRI. I can't get anything done. I'm not even able to go to work. I can't take care of my family. I can't take care of the kids. I can't cook or make do the laundry. I want one, and my neighbor had one, and my best friend had one, and I insist. And it's my due. I pay big insurance premiums, mm-hmm. or I'm on Medicare and I deserve it." And your doctor finally says, "Okay, we'll do it. Here is the order. Go get it." You get it. The report comes back from the radiologist and it says you have degenerative disc disease, or you have herniated discs, or you have black discs, or facet joint problems, or any number of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then your doctor reads you that report, and you demand to see a surgeon. And your doctor says, some of this stuff, it's kind of typical. I see a lot of people with it. Well, by that time, you're so panicked that you just have to see a surgeon, and this procedure gets rolling. You end up having spinal injections frequently. The next step is surgery, and it's often not helpful. It's sometimes very harmful.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it happens.
But it's not as if the person with the lower back pain is imagining the symptoms.
No, certainly not. The pain is real. And this is where it gets a little tricky because as a society, we've been taught to look for structural causes. You know, if you have a pain in your knee, it's your knee, and if you have a pain in your stomach, it's your stomach. Well, with back pain and possibly a number of other kinds of chronic syndromes, if you have that pain in your back and whatever injury, and I use that term very loosely because, you know, people think they picked up the newspaper off the floor and that was the injury, mm-hmm. or you know that wasn't the injury, right? You've been doing that all your life. Mm-hmm. You never had an injury from it, right? So if people believe that that inciting injury is the cause, well, once that injury has had time to heal and you still have pain, and the healing, as you know, you cut your finger really badly and maybe a week later you can't even tell you cut your finger, right? The mm-hmm. human body heals very quickly in those cases. So the injury's had time to heal. You still have the pain. The pain's no better. Well, at that point, what you're dealing with is a phenomenon called centralized sensitization. The brain is now delivering the pain. It's no longer a muscle problem. It's no longer the inflammation. The brain is delivering the pain. And I write about that extensively in my book, Crooked, because it's something that most of us just don't understand. We've been to the chiropractor. We've seen the chiropractor's spine, and we are absolutely sure that it is some little piece of that that is malfunctioning, and that's where the pain is coming from. And that is not likely to be true in a situation where the pain is chronic, which is, you know, more than 6 months. You know, subacute pain is more than 3 months or so, and acute pain is in that first period. People often say, I have acute pain, and they think they mean they have terrible, serious pain, but the term acute in this case means of recent onset.
The best chiropractor I ever had was the one who told me that I needed to get in better shape and strengthen my core.
Well, that is a great piece of advice from a chiropractor, and quite a few chiropractors these days have walked away from traditional chiropractic efforts and have moved into rehab, and that's just really a good thing. The situation that's not so good is when a traditional chiropractor, one who does adjustments and very little else and may really have a penchant for cracking your neck, when you get into those situations with a chiropractor who wants to sign you up to come in on a regular schedule to preserve your spine or your health or any number of other things that a chiropractor definitely cannot preserve, that's when you really have to be careful. I don't think that was the situation with yours. It sounds as if your chiropractor was leaning towards the rehab side, and, mm-hmm. and that, as I say, is an excellent thing.
How do insurance companies contribute or not to
this sort of onslaught of surgery?
I don't know what to call it.
I don't know about you, but I call it an onslaught of surgery.
This miscalculation in healthcare, I guess. How
well,
do they contribute?
They contribute in several interesting ways. Until very, very recently, and I was just watching this tide start to shift when the new administration came into office, and now it's really not too clear what's going to happen. But until very recently, most health insurance companies would pay for a spinal fusion surgery, which is where one or more pairs of vertebrae are basically anchored together, so they no longer move. Mm-hmm. That's the fusion. Would pay for that, and that could cost well upwards of $100,000 a year. $100,000 for the surgery, mm-hmm. okay? Plus, then there's rehab. You may end up with a patient who is addicted to painkillers, so then you have a lifelong expense as an insurer based on that. A whole string of events sometimes emerge from the decision to have that MRI, which can take you into the surgical suite, which is very expensive, but really is only the beginning of a long string of expenses that patient will incur. On the other hand, that same insurance company will not pay for intensive physical rehabilitation. They may pay for some physical therapy in a larger physical therapy center that accepts insurance, but oftentimes that physical therapy is really subpar, and back pain patients in particular have extremely poor results in those large physical therapy clinics where you might see the head physical therapist once and then you're assigned to an assistant and you spend most of your time doing your exercises for 10 minutes by yourself, and then you get heat and then you get cold and then you get muscle stimulation and then you go home and don't do your exercises for 4 days until you come back. Now, insurance companies have been loath to pick up the bill for the type of physical rehab that involves intensive exercise and requires a fair amount of supervision and has shown some very good outcomes. They've also been very loath to pick up the tab for something called cognitive behavioral therapy, which is called CBT, and that's the acronym for it, and you see CBT for back pain, which helps people really reshape their thinking about their backs, because many are encouraged sometimes by chiropractors, physical therapists, their MDs, surgeons, to feel that their backs are very fragile, that they have to be very careful, they shouldn't lift, that they should, take it easy, they should spend time lying down. A lot of recommendations for which is no scientific evidence whatsoever. And unfortunately, that's the kind of information that pervades the internet and comes out of the mouths of some people who ought to know better.
Let's hear from Tom and Marion. Tom, you're a nurse. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing? Great show.
Hi, Tom.
Good topic.
Thanks.
Hi. You guys kind of touched on what I said. I've been telling my patients for nearly 20 years that come in with back problems and complaints that what they generally don't have is a back problem. They've got a front problem. They're either the gut hanging in front of them, especially on our guys, or the fact that they just don't have the associated accessory muscles and core muscles to hold themselves up properly causes they're putting all that weight on their spine. They're doing things the wrong way. And exercise is the number one thing to alleviate back problems that I've found. So
well, that's really right, Tom. Now, I think we need to kind of define what we mean by core, because it's a bit of an overused idea and sort of improperly used. You do see a lot of recommendations for sit-ups, crunches, other heavy use of the abdominal muscle, and the reality is these can be very damaging to people with back pain. It's not that you should never do a crunch, but you absolutely have to balance that with exercises that address the large and small muscles of the back. When we stop talking, you'll take a look around and you'll see that there are people probably in your office and all around who have no gluteal muscles. They have basically flat backsides. And those gluteal muscles are required to support the spine. So are the larger muscles of the low back and the smaller muscles that run parallel to the spine and in some cases also slightly on a diagonal. And we neglect them because they don't do anything for you in a bathing suit at the beach,
Nothing does anything anymore for that,
muscles.
But anyway.
So you see everybody's in the gym doing crunches. They're working on their biceps. They're working on their thighs, but meanwhile, it's as if they can't see their backs. They don't even have backs. And one thing that I learned, I'm an investigative reporter. I've been at it for 4 decades. And I only got to this subject because I was trying to deal with my own back pain. And what I learned this very clearly by talking to many experts and being involved in various types of exercise with them, that I had practically nothing in the way of back muscles. And it just was not enough to hold me up. And I would say that the greatest change that I experienced was from really developing those muscles and continuing to work on them, you know, over years, because you can't stop.
A good workout really doesn't nowadays include much of what we think of as crunches anymore.
No, but a lot of people are doing them, believe me.
Right.
Go into a gym, take a look. People are working those crunches like crazy.
What do you think are the best exercises for everyday people to do without having to, sign up for a big fancy program or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do have some recommendations for that. On my website, which you can locate at cjramin.com, you will find a button that says resource section. And there you will find, if you type in the name Stuart McGill, McGill, you'll find a video. And Stuart McGill is a real authority on this topic, and he demonstrates the McGill's Big Three, which are conducted on your hands and knees. You only need, six feet of space or so to do them. And they really strengthen your back muscles in an appropriate way. And when I say appropriate, it means that these exercises instruct your back muscles in how to behave properly. A lot of people have back muscles and other trunk muscles that are behaving in dysfunctional ways. So the point is here to go for maximum function so your back muscles don't get confused and start doing work that they're not supposed to be doing, which often leads to back spasms and other problems.
Okay. We will have a link to Catherine Jacobson Raymond's website on our website at WOSU.org/all-size if you want to check that out. Her new book is entitled Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. Catherine Jacobson Raymond, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was real interesting.
We'll have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Most gardeners will tell you that the definition of a weed is whatever is unwanted. But visual concerns aside, they might be edible and nutritious, and you don't even know you want them. Ohio State University weed science specialist Bruce Ackley and Alyssa Lamb, a graduate research fellow in the OSU Department of Horticulture and Crop Science at OSU, recently wrote about identifying and cooking with weeds. Their new ebook is entitled Delicious Forages, Rediscovering the Lost Virtues of Edible Weeds. We'll have a link to that on our website, of course, at WOSU.org/all-sides. Bruce Ackley and Alyssa Lamb join us now. Welcome to the show. I can't talk right, but thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
It's great to be here.
Reminder, everybody, since we're talking about plants, that All Sides will be broadcasting live at Chadwick Arboretum Plant Sale this Friday from 10 to noon. So that's a great way to find edible plants as well. How do we, though, for the purposes of this conversation, define a weed? Weed expert?
So when I talk about it in class, there's the really obvious definition for weed is a plant out of place. That's kind of the go-to, and it's all based on your perspective. Is it a weed? If you don't want it there, it's a weed. If you're okay with it, if you can find value, it's not a weed. So that's really how I say it's a person-by-person case and plant-by-plant.
Are most weeds whatever? I mean, we talk about clover, we talk about dandelions, we talk about crabgrass or whatever it might be. Are they mostly edible?
It really depends on a case by case basis.
It really varies. A lot of these plants you have to think are just plants. So, you know, in history they've been used for medicinal purposes, but as agriculture picked up, they've kind of gotten the weed label.
They've been lost
in
the shuffle. How did you guys go about rediscovering what works?
Research and trials, you know.
Yeah.
So you've been eaten.
Put your
money where your mouth is, literally.
Yep. Every recipe in this book has been cooked and recipe tested by us.
There's recipes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a number of recipes for each species. And then the recipes kind of go from a safe, like, I want to try just a little bit of the weed, up to, like, I'm going to get a big mouthful and really get the full flavor of it. So we kind of stagger the recipes so you have options as to how, you know, much you want to dip your toes in.
How did you said research, but how did you even, did you just start to look at history through history and see what historically?
One of the labs I teach, we actually do an edible weed section. So I've been teaching and cooking with weeds for about 10 years now. And it just kind of over time, it was something we both love cooking and eating. And it was like, what else can we do with weeds? And it was like, oh, what's a cookbook?
It's kind of our fun project. We have a couple other books that are pretty scientific and technical. So for this one, we kind of branched out and did something fun.
Well, that's nice. And we thank you for it. Dandelion is probably the most well-known edible weed. Are we talking about the same? Are there different kinds of dandelions? Is it the one in the backyard that we're talking about right now?
Yep.
The one in your backyard.
Now, let me ask you about this because I immediately thought about this. A lot of people use chemicals on their lawn now. Are those things rendering a lot of those otherwise edible weeds inedible?
Yeah, you don't want to eat anything that's been sprayed with herbicide. It's always, you want to go, if you're going to go foraging, you want to go into like more natural areas, something that you know what, if any control has been done, what is the control. But yeah, anything with herbicides, just say no to.
Something we did actually with my garden at home. You know, the garden is a typically safe place to eat from. So, you know, weed your garden and then eat those weeds. Kind of look at it as a second resource.
All right. So let's talk about some of those weeds that are going to pop up in a garden. What are they? What are you talking about? How do I know?
This book showcases five different weeds.
Uh-huh.
Common lamb's quarters, chickweed. And each of these weeds does have an ID section. So we walk you through how to identify and make sure you know that you have the right weed.
Yeah, and we list common similar species and how to tell them apart. So if you find something that looks right, you can go through the technical steps of making sure you're actually eating the right plant, not something that's similar and might be hazardous.
I was going to say, whatever qualifies as edible is something that won't kill you, right?
Or or make you sick. There's,
yeah.
I mean, and everybody,
it ranges.
We have a nice disclaimer in the front of, like, if, you know, if these are things that you haven't eaten before, you know, maybe try just a little bit. Or if there's similar species you know you're allergic to that are more commonly cultivated, then it probably wouldn't be good to go have the wild equivalent also.
Uh-huh.
So it's always make sure you know what you're eating, make sure you ID'd it correctly, start with a little bit, and then if you like it, work your way up.
Are non-herbicide, you know, non-chemically weeds, are they particularly nutritious?
Yeah, there are also nutrition facts for each weed. Actually, the USDA has a really nice website if you're interested in this kind of thing. But, you know, compared to spinach, like lamb's quarter actually is more nutritious. And you think of spinach as a, you
like
know.
Like more iron?
Yeah, it has a lot of different vitamins and minerals.
Yeah, they're all actually pretty, really healthy. I mean, there's a nice spectrum of vitamins and nutrients and minerals that are available by just natural plants.
Do you necessarily cook them differently
than like their cultivated counterparts, or just
a lot of
the
really.
Recipes are we kind of be like lamb's quarter is a good example. Common lamb's quarter, it's known to be similar to spinach, so a lot of the recipes are like, well, what if we took spinach out and put lamb's quarter in, or played with that flavor. When we first started, it was literally going out foraging the weeds and then sitting down and just eating
the weed raw,
just
green
raw
weeds, and taking notes on like, oh, what do I get from this? What's the flavor? What's the texture? Mm-hmm. What could we do with this? What would work? What wouldn't work? And not all the recipes, not all the ideas worked.
Yeah, not everything panned out.
Give me an example of what didn't pan out.
So we have nutsedge tubers. It's not actually the plant. It's the little tubers you find on the roots.
Yellow nutsedge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we thought that would make an interesting hummus if treated like a chickpea. So we roasted and ground up the nuts edge, and it actually turned into like this gelatinous blob of hot goo. We didn't even actually try to eat that one. We were just, nope, that's not going to work.
Yeah, the tubers tasted delicious, but then the execution just did not, it did not turn out well.
So the tubers, if you roasted them, tasted good. Mm-hmm. But if you tried to mush them up and make them a dip, it didn't work.
Right. There, and well, we blended them and did like a horchata, and that was great. And we put them in the food processor and made cookies out of them, and those were phenomenal. They're like a shortbread cookie.
Wow.
Just the raw tubers, when they're young, they're this really pristine white, and they're a little bit soft, just a little bit. And they're sweet. They taste, I mean, delicious. It's like something you could have snackful. And that's why we tried roasting the older ones, and that softened those up. And they were basically kind of like walking around with like a bag of peanuts.
Right. So we learned to treat them more of as a nut than a legume.
Yeah.
Right, right. And yellow nuts edge, I'm trying to figure out, what is that? I mean, is it something I would recognize?
A lot of people like the spikes is what like gardeners refer to them. They look like a grass, but they have a triangular stem, and they're kind of a lighter green,
like a
almost to a yellow.
Okay.
And they're really glossy. But yeah, you see a nuts edge is pretty common all over. Like the weeds that are in here are ones that you might not know you're seeing them every day, but you're probably seeing them every day.
Purslane. So this was given to me, but you write that purslane is often confused with various spurge species. What in the world is a spurge species? I mean,
Prostate spurge is probably the biggest one, spotted spurge. They have the similar bright red stem,
They're
usually more of a prostrate growth, and they have stacked leaves going up the stem that are opposite.
Mm-hmm.
I have to think about. I have a lot of weeds rumbling around in my head. But the spurges have milky sap, and that's the dead giveaway to tell them versus the purslane. The purslane actually kind of looks like a plastic plant. It's very very glossy. It's thick. It's super succulent.
Pink.
In southern cultures, South America particularly, they pickle it a lot and just go for it like that, which we talked about doing that, but never.
Yeah.
Did you find that a lot of recipes came from other cultures?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like I said, a lot of these had been used and are used in other
foraging type
cultures.
Yeah, other cultures and countries, these are still staple foods.
Mm-hmm.
It's here that they've kind of lost favor for more, you know, cultivated, packaged.
Right.
You know, we have a lot of mainstream stuff.
I think
here.
We're kind of getting back to that, though. If you go to some grocery stores, you can find dandelion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And amaranth seed and, you know, different weeds.
Is the dandelion that I get in the grocery going to be the same thing? Again, assuming that you haven't put chemicals on it, the same thing in my backyard.
Yep.
There's one kind of dandelion.
There's different kinds of dandelion, but the one, like common dandelion, the one that is in your backyard and at the grocery store, it's the same kind. When it's cultivated for, you know, being sold in a store, it's bigger, it's green, it's probably a little less stringy and a little less bitter.
Okay.
If you're collecting your dandelion from your backyard or, you know, like I have a fence that goes around my backyard and a lot of our stuff came, I could just walk back to the fence row and pluck it right out, and it was next to my garden too. If you get it when it's young, a lot of the weeds, you want those just a little bit bigger than a seedling.
Okay.
They have a lot more succulents, good flavor.
A little more tender and flavorful when they're young.
Yeah.
Did you guys find yourself cultivating these?
Yeah.
In a sense. My mom wasn't too happy that we left all the weeds in our garden, but it worked out well for us.
Yeah. We also got a veg trug.
Yeah.
And had that going.
Mm-hmm. So we
a veg trug. It's kind of like a raised
like a trough.
Bed.
Oh, okay. Trough. Yeah, sure. Okay.
They use them at the university for a few different things to grow stuff outside so we can keep them out of the greenhouse environment so we're not, you know, spraying them with any fungicides or herbicides or anything like that. So we had them going there. So we had a certain amount just handy to go. So whenever we wanted to cook, we could go harvest and go right to the kitchen.
Yep.
I have an email from Carl who asks, what about Japanese knotweed, whether or not that's edible?
I have not read about it being edible.
It's a very
problematic weed,
right.
But I do not. I've never read it being edible before.
It has a pretty woody stem. I would assume the only thing you could eat is the leaves, but I don't even know if that's edible. We might have to do some research.
Yeah.
Time to do some research. Yeah, I was going to say, this book that you've written, let's see. I got to get the name of the book again. Delicious Forages, Rediscovering the Lost Virtues of Edible Weeds. It's something you could expand on, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's the great thing about our digital book initiative is once you purchase the book, it is completely free updates. So any additional recipes for the weeds we have or, you know, current additional chapters will be free.
Yeah, we have currently 5 books published,
and
all of them we've mm-hmm. launched multiple updates. And the nice thing about having them like on Google and iTunes is people comment, and you can be like, oh, you know, this picture here, I don't know if it was all that helpful, or this picture was really helpful. And so we have the option of just updating on demand, and then you get a little update icon on your phone, tablet, computer. You click the update, the new pictures upload, the new content uploads. So the theory is we're actually working on amaranth species now, and that'll be the next update.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Ackley, thanks really much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, this was fantastic.
Bruce Ackley, Extension Program Specialist, Weed Science and Weed Team Head Coach at Ohio State University. Who knew? And Alyssa Lamb, thanks to you as well.
Yeah,
I appreciate it. Alyssa Lamb is a graduate student at Ohio State University, and together they have written a new ebook entitled Delicious Forages, Rediscovering the Lost Virtues of Edible Weeds. That's it for Wellness Wednesday. Thanks for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.